This is Radio Parallax, a slightly different perspective from a slightly different view, with topics that include matters in science, technology, history, politics, current events, and whatever we damn well please. And now the host of Radio Parallax, Douglas Everett.
I confess to being in a bit of a pensive mood before starting to record this particular program. That has only been made much worse by the news today of the loss of a second former Radio Parallax guest, which we were privileged to have on, who stood up for what he thought was right and did a hell of a lot of good. I'm referring in this instance to Dr. Cyril Wecht, who I'm informed this morning just passed away. We were planning and are still planning to tell you about someone else we admired very much and spoke with, that being the late Congressman Pete McCloskey, who passed away last week. It was a great honor for us to be able to sit down and speak with both of these men about their opinions on things. We spoke with Dr. Wecht very early on. I think his first appearance is on show number 69, wherein he talked about his recent book, Mortal Error. We plan to play a clip from that interview in our second segment today. But of course, the entire segment is available to you by simply going to our website, radioparallax.com. We will also be excerpting from Pete McCloskey's several appearances on this program. We spent a bit of time with him, Mr. Millen and I did, out at his ranch, and put together, I think, at least an hour's worth of recorded material, which we then doled out to you. His first appearance was on show number 264, also available in its entirety to you on our website. We will do some excerpts from our chat with Pete McCloskey in our second segment as well. And I hope entertain you with a few anecdotes about both men. We have some curious addenda for today's program related to a surprising connection yours truly made, courtesy of another old friend of the program, in this case, Dr. Roger Orman. But that, too, I think is going to have to wait till our second segment today. And before we get too far into this, our first segment of today's program, I note that we are in desperate need of your feedback, dear listener. We want to hear from you. We need to hear from you, actually, about where it is you hear us. Do you listen to this program on terrestrial radio via KDVS, or do you listen to our podcasts at radioparallax.com? We would like some information from you about how it is you listen, how often you listen. And, we have a monetary question. Mr. Millen and I have done a rather terrible job, I would say, over the years of managing this program in terms of getting some return from the listenership in order to continue our work. It's been something of a charitable institution, I would say, Radio Parallax. Mr. Millen likes to think of it as being good for the free people of the world, and we hope it is.
A civic duty.
That said, to continue in the future, we probably could use just a bit of an income stream. And so when you respond to us, and I hope you will, dear listener, we do need to hear from you, you will offer an opinion of to whether you think it would be worth to spend, say, a dollar to listen to a Radio Parallax program. The way we look at it is if you went on iTunes and spent 99 cents to hear, say, you know, Snoopy versus the Red Baron, or perhaps downloading Inagata Da Vida, we do understand that there's a trade-off between, being able to listen to something you would like to hear and being willing to shell out a small sum by which you can do so. I know our friends over at This Week in Science on KDVS use Patreon to obtain some of the funding they need to put out their program. But it's rather pathetic to note that we know actually very little about it because we haven't really looked at how that could be done. If you're a marketing person, we really do want to hear from you at info@radioparallax.com. I know that a lot of people are out there earning an income from their podcasts, and that's the American way, isn't it? This calls to mind, to Mr. McMillan anyway, the famous National Lampoon cover from the 1970s wherein they put on the front of the magazine, a picture of a gun pointed at a dog's head with the line, "If you don't buy this magazine, we'll shoot this dog." Now, of course, that was all a joke. No dogs were harmed in the creation of that cover. And I have to confess, I have put the kibosh in Mr. McMillan's scheme to put a gun to my head and suggest that if we don't contribute, something bad could happen. This is all just a joke, folks. But the truth is, if we're going to continue into 2024, and we expect to do so, and maybe even into 2025 and beyond, we really do need to just step up our game a little bit. And that means you, dear listener, as our partners in crime, need to step up your game just a little bit. And by the way, thank you, those of you who contributed to the KDVS fund drive a couple weeks back. The station made something like $40,000. During this particular pledge drive. This, I have to say, is a bit of a far cry from the $60,000 or $70,000 that were raised as recently as like 15 years ago. When you factor inflation into that, that would put the sum more like at 100, which means that our $40,000 really falls a bit short of what is needed. Now, we do note that we are underwriting KDVS ourselves by presenting this program cost-free to the station. We were both rather amused to discover recently through our good friend Guy Tortorisi, who's airing this program on KDVS, if you're listening on 90.3 FM. And again, yeah, thanks, Guy. But apparently some of the core staff at the station were unaware of our largesse and were wondering how it was they should compensate both us and Planetary Radio. But the fact is, Planetary Radio is free to the station, and so are we. Now, we're not saying if somebody wants to go back and look at the fact that, you know, 1,000 shows have aired on KDVS free of charge, they may want to, you know, feeling guilty about it, want to compensate us for that. Well, at $10 a show, that would be $10,000, which, of course, we would no doubt just redonate to the station. But yeah, we hate to even have this conversation, but you know, it seems to be a problem everywhere. I know that the local NPR stalwart, KQED, heard in the Sacramento area as KQEI, they too are having a great deal of trouble of fundraising. I think it has to do with the fact that people are just not listening to radio as much as they did in the past, or downloading it for free. I don't know the answer to this, but it does seem pretty clear that our internet-driven media is eating away not only at America's newspapers, but also at radio, which depends on advertising in the grand scheme of things, certainly not on a public station like this one. But we do feel the need to, at some point, you know, try to follow the money. Some years back, we had on Rick Anderson, who was formerly the general manager of KZFR in Chico, a station which saw fit to air this program for many, many years. And Rick explained how it was that by seeking grants and by seeking partnerships with local businesses, the station did very well. I'm talking about at the tune of, like, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, both in sponsorships and through grants. This is a model we've encouraged them to follow at KDVS, and certainly hope that they will do so. All right, now, Mr. McMillan, it's time for us to go back to being oblivious to financial matters. And what better way to get back in the swim of things than to do one of our perennial favorites, the good, the bad, and the ugly. I should note that over the years, we've taken what we thought was good advice from listeners and friends. And one thing that turned out to be a surprisingly good piece of advice was that I check out The Week magazine. By its very nature, The Week is comprehensive, tries to cover all sides of the issue, which allows us to pick the one we like everyone else that reads the magazine does. Their whimsical Good Week 4, Bad Week 4 section certainly has allowed us to transmogrify it into our version, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Anyway, I've got several editions of the magazine. Six, in fact, from which to choose some of our selections. And I think I'm just going to have a field day by going through these one by one. The Week notes it was a good week a few weeks back for getting noticed with the news that a German museum fired one of their employees who had secretly hung his own painting alongside works by Dali and Picasso. German police said the man had hoped to achieve an artistic breakthrough. And no, we're not sure that he was able to achieve the breakthrough that he sought, but we like this guy. At the same time, it was apparently a bad week that week, several weeks back, for salad, with the news that the Tennessee State Senate passed a bill to tackle the scourge of vaccine lettuce. We would hasten to add the non-existent scourge of vaccine lettuce. GOP State Senator Frank Nicely said scientists were secretly plotting to, quote, mass medicate, unquote, the population, quote, like they do with fluoride in the water, unquote. And it was an ugly week several weeks back for, well, I guess you'd say knowing your history, after Donald Trump declared during a campaign speech in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, that the Battle of Gettysburg, in which more than 50,000 both Union and Confederate troops were killed or wounded, was, quote, so beautiful in so many different ways, unquote. To which we at Radio Parallax have to editorialize, well, actually, not so much, no. Well, let's do another round. More recently than the last trio, but some weeks back, it was a good week for, I'd have to say, grave robbing. With the news, and this one really stuns me, the news that a gold pocket watch retrieved from the body of the richest passenger in the Titanic, John Jacob Astor, sold at auction for $1.46 million, described as a record price for a piece of Titanic memorabilia. Now, how it is they set an automatic device into the rusting hulk of the Titanic, 12,000 feet down on the bottom of the Atlantic, to probe until they found what appeared to be the remains of John Jacob Astor. Good God.
And why doesn't the watch belong to his kin?
I would think that it would. I mean, that's just grave robbing. But isn't it great to know what technology can accomplish these days? Anyway, it would have to be described as a bad week for the Word of God recently, after the group Catholic Answers defrocked an AI chatbot it released last month to, quote, spread the beauty of Catholicism, unquote. The AI was named Father Justin and had apparently approved the use of Gatorade to baptize babies.
That makes me want to become a Catholic.
Yeah, sure. And apparently the AI told at least one user, I'm as real as the faith we share. And it was an ugly week, I guess last week, for criminal justice, with the news that the man who attacked Dave Chappelle during a performance at the Hollywood Bowl is now suing the venue, claiming its security staff were too aggressive in restraining him. Isaiah Lee, age 25, admits he rushed the stage and tackled the comedian and that he was in possession of a knife. Still, Lee says the security team's response left him not only with a dislocated shoulder, but also suffering, quote, anxiety, grief, shock, humiliation, and embarrassment. Now, don't you think that if you decide in your own mind that what you want to do is rush the stage with a knife and tackle the performer, that that itself would underlie the cause of your anxiety, grief, shock, humiliation, and embarrassment? Well, we think so here at Radio Parallax, but this is America, and you can sue anybody for anything. And we would have to add that it was both a bad and ugly week, I guess last week, for South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem, who took a lot of flack and is now considered no longer vice presidential material under Trump, for shooting her dog, something she described in her memoir. Now, I don't want to be too harsh to judge here. This is not Lassie we're talking about. This was a really bad behaving dog that was attacking chickens and not behaving and running amok. Oh, at least according to the description of Governor Noem. We're never going to know. But what I like best about this story is that after she suffered criticism for her admission of shooting her dog, the governor has doubled down on the whole matter, noting that Joe Biden's dog, Commander, has now attacked 24 Secret Service people, which caused her to say on CBS's Face the Nation, how many is enough before you make a decision on a dog? For the record, Mr. McMillan opposes the death penalty for canines.
Most canines.
Well, except for like mad dogs, right?
Rabid dogs, yes.
Okay, all right.
Old Yeller.
And finally, here's an item we're not sure whether it's good or bad or ugly or just what combination of the three, but the story is that a Pennsylvania woman has lost a 5-year legal battle to be refunded 24 cents, which she paid in sales tax on a bottle of Perrier. Jennifer Montgomery argued that Perrier is simply water, which is a necessity of life and should be exempt from sales tax. However, the Pennsylvania State Court ruled that Perrier is rightly taxed as a, quote, soda, unquote, because its natural carbonation is, in fact, augmented by a process like those used to carbonate Coca-Cola and Pepsi. And yes, if you are a fan of Perrier, which here at the program we decidedly are not, you should be aware of the fact that while the company claims that the water is naturally carbonated, they do, in fact, pump it full of CO2 to augment whatever natural carbonation may be present.
Tiny bubbles make me warm all over. Well, the feeling that I'm gonna love you till the end of time.
And you know, something I said at the top of the show we talk about in segment two, I think I'm going to move up and talk about it now. At a rather lovely get-together in the beautiful foothills town of Murphy's over the weekend, this correspondent crossed paths with someone whose mom used to write for The New Yorker for many decades and who for a while was the film critic at The New York Times. The son of the erstwhile film critic informed us that that one of his mom's claim to fame was that she almost sank the movie career of Mel Brooks. Now, back in 1968, Mel Brooks decided to move from being a TV writer and comedic performer into being a movie producer. Or was it director? Or was it both? I don't know. He certainly was the director and possibly the producer of The Producers. Now, for my money, the only movie that I would rank as funny or funnier than The Producers would be the legendary This Is Spinal Tap, of which a remake is currently underway, and we can hardly wait. Now, The Producers has something of a life of its own. We've talked about this on the show before, how it was that a movie that was a flop was nevertheless considered a classic. Financial flop, critical success, was, many years later, converted by Mel Brooks into a stage production, which was both a critical and commercial success, despite the fact that in this correspondent's opinion, it stunk. Now, I confess, the version I saw on the stage did not contain Nathan Lane, which might have saved it somewhat. But we've marveled on this show in the past at the irony of a flop movie that was considered a comedy classic by some being turned into a play that was widely hailed and yet not so good. At least in my humble opinion. The final plot twist is they took the play and remade the movie, which in this case was both a critical and commercial flop. And of course, Mr. McMillan points out that there's multiple ironies in this, being that the original producers set out to make a deliberately bad play that would flop, that somehow succeeded and caused all kinds of trouble. Anyway, I had to note with amusement that the son of former movie critic Renata Adler said that his mom really didn't like Zero Mostel's performance and how he was just running amok, chewing up the scenery, as the phrase goes. Which, of course, is exactly why the movie works. I was informed that apparently the DVD of Blazing Saddles in one of the extras contains Mel Brooks' description of how it was he was almost sunk by this review, this mixed review that he received in the New York Times. Apparently, his wife and others took him aside and said, "No, Mel, you should keep making movies," which he did to, I think, everyone's satisfaction. But yeah, the whole thing almost got, you know, killed in the cradle. Anyway, to just quote one little phrase out of this review from March of 1968, the movie begins with Zero Mostel overacting grotesquely under the direction of Mel Brooks. No, Zero Mostel was being masterful in his performance. And I'm glad to see that that is now almost universally recognized. And I think that's about all I have to say about that for the moment.
What about Zero Mostel? Did he do anything before that?
Oh, yeah. He was a known quantity. He got caught up in the whole blacklist of Hollywood because he was quite a noted lefty. And he didn't work for many years on account of it. But apparently he was famous for being just masterful on the stage. I think he was in Rhinoceros, where I guess I've never seen the Ionesco, Eugene Ionesco's play, but apparently at some point the person on stage is expected to transform from a human into a rhinoceros. And frankly, I don't think many actors are capable of that, but apparently Zero Mostel was.
He should have won a Tony.
Maybe.
And whoever cast him for the producers nailed it.
You know, and if we're going to plug Zero Mostel, and I guess we are, I also want to point out that he is masterful in A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, which came out at roughly the same time. I'm not sure which one came first. Anyway, dear listener, if you've never seen either one of these movies, I envy you, because that means you can sit down and watch both of them for the first time, something we strongly recommend that you consider doing. Anyway, it might be time to do, some perspective on more serious matters. Although, at the moment, I'm reminded of that scene in This is Spinal Tap, where the three knucklehead musicians are at Graceland, peering out at all these graveside floral arrangements, and one of the characters says, "Well, it puts things in perspective." To which another answers, "Too bloody much perspective." Right now, I think we're suffering from too bloody much perspective. Let's start by acknowledging a couple of tech birthdays. Turns out that Gmail had its 20th birthday in April. Apparently, when Google announced it was launching a free email service on April Fool's Day back in 2004, no one was quite sure if the search giant was serious. It's noted that it's hard to imagine a world without Gmail now. Its most controversial innovation was that instead of using pop-up or banner ads, it used the text in your email to serve up ads. At the time, this unnerved people, but in the meantime, we've all sort of gotten used to it, haven't we?
It still unnerves me.
Well, as I guess you pointed out in the past, you should never put anything in an email that you don't want to have read to a grand jury. And yes, I shudder to think of some of the things I put into print. And on May 1st, it marks the 60th birthday of the Basic Programming Language. Evidently, it was on May Day, 1964, that mathematicians John G. Kameny and Thomas E. Kurtz at Dartmouth College successfully ran the first program written in their newly developed BASIC, Beginner's All-Purpose Symbolic Instruction Code, BASIC. That was on General Electric's GE225 mainframe. The easy-to-grasp syntax of BASIC stood in contrast to the complex languages used by professionals at the time and helped usher in an era of personal computers from companies like Apple and Commodore. And speaking of scary technology, which we would note that according to the Wall Street Journal, since 2015, Amazon has been spying on rivals' online platforms through a fake company called Big River Services International. This sells products under various brand names such as Atlantic Lot and Rapid Cascade. Big River was in fact part of an Amazon initiative called Project Curiosity. Its entire staff consisted of Amazon employees. They disseminated their reports to Amazon executives using printed numbered copies rather than email and had prepared responses to questions in the event of a leak to the media. Amazon appears to know that it was cutting things close. Employees working on Project Curiosity were even told to never email screenshots of competitors' pricing and systems. Of course, a weak point in all this is that some countries, like the UK, required Big River to list its corporate owners. Amazon officials felt confident the competitors wouldn't look up filings to see who was behind the company. And in another apparent Amazon oversight, it turns out that Amazon's innovative Just Walk Out technology, once billed as the future of retail because it allowed consumers to buy items and exit its grocery stores without checking out, well, the company said hundreds of AI-powered cameras armed with computer vision, sensor fusion, and deep learning were monitoring shoppers' actions. But it didn't mention that it partially relied on more than 1,000 people in India who were watching and labeling videos to make sure the checkouts were in fact accurate. And wouldn't you know it, the cost of all these human babysitters apparently got the better of Amazon, which, you know, wants to rely on robots whenever possible, which caused it to announce last week it was going to phase out the just walk out method and rely on tech-laden dash carts instead. The Financial Times noted that retail really requires a human touch, noting that it's no coincidence that most of these stores that reported unexpected jumps in retail theft had ramped up use of self-checkout and sensors during the pandemic. All those empty aisles and unmanned registers proved vulnerable to pilfering. Apparently, 21% of self-checkout users told LendingTree that, quote, they have mistakenly failed to pay for an item, unquote. 15% admitted to stealing deliberately. And it is said that the stores who tried to cut costs by eliminating cashiers have only themselves to blame. Mr. Millen points out that if you fail to take advantage of the walkout with a paying scheme, well, you always have the option of just moving to San Francisco, where apparently paying for items is considered so 20th century. And the final piece of advice we're going to relay to you also comes from the Wall Street Journal, something we don't quote from very often. But apparently Joe Pinsker, writing in the journal, suggested if you're driving an older car, don't sell it. There have always been people who relish driving cars till the wheels fall off, this correspondent included. And recently, the case for this frugal personal finance move has grown stronger. The average cost of a new vehicle was $46,000 in March, up from $40,000 just 3 years earlier. And newer models have become more expensive to repair. So we say, keep your jalopy. We also need to point out that a break is needed, so let's take one. You're listening to Radio Parallax. I'm Douglas Everett. Got plenty more. Stick around.